This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Not so long ago, global carbon dioxide rose a shocking 40 parts per million in just a few decades. Humans were alive then, but ecologically speaking, we were just animals. Scientists are rushing to find the cause of that natural instability and whether it could happen again. From Australia, Dr. Laurie Menviel explains. We are also joined by Matt Fitzpatrick, head of the Global Change and Biodiversity Lab, where you can find a map showing the future climate for most cities in North America, similar to one available for Europe. In between, you will hear tidbits of the latest from British journalist and climate campaigner George Monbiot at an Extinction Rebellion event. I'm Alex Smith. Find the future here on Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
The Great Southern Ocean, reaching down to Antarctica, has absorbed up to 10% of our greenhouse gas emissions. Without that, we would be much hotter already. But that ocean sink appears to be weakening. In a worst-case scenario, scientists are exploring why carbon dioxide jumped 40 parts per million in a few decades, and not that long ago, and whether that natural increase in warming gases could happen again. Dr. Laurie Menviel is a leading scientist in the field with many papers. She is currently a researcher at the University of New South Wales in Australia. Laurie was just awarded the 2019 Dorothy Hill Medal for her work as a groundbreaking young scientist. From Sydney, Laurie Menviel, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here.
Your field of study, it seems huge to me. How would you describe your work?
Well, I'm interested in periods of abrupt climate change and particularly in the role of the oceanic circulation. So most of my research focuses on constraining changes in oceanic circulation and understanding their impact on climate, the carbon cycle, and the continental ice sheets.
Well, today we come to you out of concern for our common climate future, but to get there, we do need to examine relatively abrupt climate shifts in the past. Please tell us about the brand new record of past climate published by a big team led by A.P. Hasenfratz.
Yes, so Hasenfratz recently published his exciting new record. So Hasenfratz and Carter present a 1.5 million years record from the Southern Ocean. So they took a marine sediment core in the Southern Ocean, and they analyzed both surface and deep changes in temperature and the oxygen isotopic composition, which is here a proxy for salinity. So from there, they can infer changes in or past changes in ocean stratification in the Southern Ocean. So what they find is an increase in Southern Ocean stratification during glacial times as Earth's climate went through a fairly large transition whereby the glacial times became much more intense. So this is known as the Middle Pleistocene transition. So basically, their study, what it does, it highlights the possible role of changes in Southern Ocean stratification in the climate and the carbon cycle.
You know, as a lay person, it appears from reading your papers that in Earth's latest glacial times and what you're describing, the planet's climate went a bit rogue. It was departing from that previously predictable cycle caused by our orbit and our tilt. What do you think changed?
Yeah, so basically over the last, let's say, million years and even more than that, Earth's natural variability has been dominated by what we call glacial interglacial cycles. So due to Earth's orbit around the sun, we do go from relatively warm period interglacial down to cold period glacial. But there are feedbacks within the Earth systems that amplify those cycles, and those are changes in continental ice sheet and in greenhouse gases, so namely atmospheric CO2 or methane. And so what happened is that, let's say, before this transition, the mid-Pleistocene transition, which occurred somewhere in between 1.2 million years and 700,000 years ago, so before this transition, there were glacial-interglacial cycles, but with a fairly small amplitude, both in terms of climate and CO2. And when we went through this transition, glacial became much more severe, they became much colder, and atmospheric CO2 was also much lower. So we're trying to understand what happened, and in fact, the community is still really trying to fully comprehend the transition. But what comes out of it is that we know that atmospheric carbon dioxide is a very strong greenhouse gas and can impact significantly the climate. And we know that it decreased significantly, and this could be due to several effects, one of them being changes in the oceanic circulation in the North Atlantic. So North Atlantic deep water maybe became weaker and shallower. We also know that maybe iron fertilization in the Southern Ocean increased, so boosting up the production in the Southern Ocean, which then leads to more carbon storage in the ocean and less carbon in the atmosphere. And what Azenfrat highlighted is also changes in Southern Ocean stratification, so most likely a weaker circulation in the Southern Ocean, which can also lead to more carbon storage in the ocean and less in the atmosphere.
Well, I think this is a really important point, because we have what was predictable by our position in space and the way the sun operates, and then we go into a period which just humans evolved during this period, where something on Earth itself changed. And so we're very concerned that changes right here on Earth could again happen. And is that why you're doing your research?
Well, yes. So what we're trying to really understand is the feedbacks and that occur in the Earth system. So what glacial interglacial cycle show us is that there are what we call positive feedbacks. And so if you change something, then it becomes bigger and bigger and bigger. I mean, it's not only positive, because obviously when we are in a very cold period, then it becomes warm again very quickly. So there are this series of feedbacks and interaction within the climate system that can lead to sometimes rapid changes or et cetera. So yes, this period is really important to understand, just to understand the Earth system, how it works, and if we understand better that, then we can better predict what's going to happen.
If we look at just the Northern Hemisphere, how big were those changes between deep glacial times and the interglacial period, say in temperatures? How much did things vary?
Well, if you look at the equator, the changes were fairly small, let's say in the tropics, they were in between 1 to 2 degrees Celsius in the ocean. But as you move towards the poles, they become larger and larger. And ice core record from Greenland suggests maybe up to 20 degrees Celsius changes, so fairly large, and maybe about the same in Antarctica.
And did that take thousands of years, or how fast did those changes happen?
So there are several kind of variability, but if we look at the glacial-interglacial variability, we know a deglaciation, so a transition from a full glacial to an interglacial, takes about 10,000 of years in total. But there are periods within that where there is a much more rapid warming. So it's not like a constant and slow change in temperature. It's more like period, maybe you go back into a colder state and then suddenly it becomes very warm again and then it changes. So we have seen in the record, let's say, periods of abrupt warming in Greenland, for example, where you can have a temperature increase of about 8 degrees Celsius in just a few decades, so in less than 100 years. Those are so much. You can have very rapid warming.
For most of us, it's surprising to learn that the Earth doesn't always warm or cool as a whole, but that the two poles seem to alternate. Do we know why a colder period in Greenland was accompanied by a warming closer to the South Pole?
Yeah, so what happens is that within this glacial-interglacial variability, we also have what we call periods of abrupt climate change, and those periods seem to be due to changes in the oceanic circulation. So right now we have formation of deep water in the North Atlantic, so in the Labrador Sea and the Nordic seas, and so this water becomes very dense and sink to the bottom of the ocean and flow southward in the Atlantic. And so this oceanic circulation also drives a surface flow, so there is a heat transport from the tropics to the North Atlantic, for example. So when this formation of deep water is fairly intense, we have fairly warm condition in the North Atlantic, for example, England, you have this Gulf Stream, which is part of the circulation, brings heat from the tropics to the UK, maintaining a fairly mild climate there. But we know that during past periods, this formation of deep water weakens significantly or even maybe completely shut off. So when this happens, you completely reduce your heat transport to the North Atlantic and you have very cold conditions over the whole North Atlantic, Greenland, Europe, etc. But since the ocean is the one transporting the heat, if you wish, when you actually reduce your transport to the North Atlantic, you can keep more heat in the south, in the Southern Ocean. So when you have this period of very strong cooling in the north, you have maybe warmer condition in the south. But there are also things that, details that we don't really fully comprehend. And right now we always think about Southern Ocean as a passive, as being passive simply, so just responding to changes in the North Atlantic. But this might not be so simple, and there might be changes in circulation in the south as well, influencing this heat redistribution. And also one of the important aspects is that the atmospheric carbon dioxide composition might also change during this event, potentially influencing or amplifying the changes.
Now, have you been studying solely a story at the poles? I mean, how do we know that at times the change was global?
So not myself, but a lot of people study climate archives. So if we want to look into what happened in the past, we rely on those archives. So they can be ice cores from the pole, as you say, from Greenland or from Antarctica, but they can also be marine sediment cores that are taken all over the Atlantic Ocean or even in the Pacific and Indian Ocean. So when you analyze those marine sediment cores, you can see changes that happen at several places on Earth. And we also have terrestrial archives. So, for example, some archives that are very useful are paleotemps. And we know from Chinese paleotemps that the Asian monsoon changed significantly. Or we also know from paleotemps in Turkey or Italy that precipitation was significantly different during those periods of time. There are also lake records that can tell us, records from Europe or from South America, for example. So we know that those events were global. And then what we use as well are numerical simulations. So we use models, numerical models, and we try to reproduce what happened maybe in the North Atlantic or in the Southern Ocean. And then we understand what the drivers were and what the impact were, and we can see that the impacts were global.
Most of the climate scientists are in the Northern Hemisphere still, and we know a lot more about the North Atlantic than the South Atlantic. I wonder if a bias has developed that favors the Arctic as a driver of big changes while leaving out some important developments in Australia and in the Antarctic. What do you think?
Yeah, so it's an interesting point you're raising, and obviously there is a bit of that. And I think mostly in terms of the climate archive we have. So we have very good climate archive from Greenland, and a lot of sediment cores, marine sediment cores, have been taken from the North Atlantic. So we know that the North Atlantic was very viable, and we also know that the formation of North Atlantic deep water has a significant impact on climate globally. So this has been studied in quite a bit of details, and we try to have a kind of an idea that, you know, the North Atlantic is a significant driver of global climate change. But over the years, we're now starting also to understand that it's not only the North Atlantic, but the North Pacific, for example, can also have an impact on all of the Pacific, if you want, climate, and the Southern Ocean. So both regions are understudied, both in terms of climate archive and modeling, but we're getting there. We are trying to realize that those regions can also have a significant impact, and we're working on it. And we also, of course, have to take into account that we know that the North Atlantic is a significant driver, but it's been highlighted over the recent years that the tropical Pacific is also very important. And if you think about El Niño-Southern Oscillation, we know it has one of the main modes of viability in the equatorial Pacific, and has significant impacts through teleconnection on both the Southern Ocean and maybe other regions. So, yes, the climate system as a whole is kind of tied together.
Laurie Manfield, you have studied in detail the rapid transition from the last glacial time to our present climate. When did that happen, and how fast did it occur?
Yeah, so the last transition, so what we call the last deglaciation from the last glacial maximum to our present interglacial, occurred from about 18,000 years ago to 10,000 years ago, so in about 8,000 years. But it was not a gradual change. As I say, we had abrupt climate variability within this transition, so when it went from colder to warmer, etc.
Do we know what caused a fairly quick burst of 40 parts per million carbon dioxide at the end of the last ice age?
Yeah, so that's something that's very interesting. So just at the end, to get out of this glacial climate, there was an abrupt event in the North Atlantic, in fact, where we're seeing the formation of North Atlantic deep water weakened significantly. So Greenland and Europe was in one of its coldest stage right at the end of the last glacial. But on the other hand, we see that the Southern Hemisphere started to warm. So Antarctica started to warm, Southern Ocean became warmer, and atmospheric CO2, as you said, increased by 40 parts per million in just about 1,000 years, with some within this period, with some parts that where we see a significant increase over just a few hundred years. And so the hypothesis we put forward and in our modeling framework, but that's also been confirmed by some climate archive, is that the changes in the upwelling in the Southern Ocean were a significant driver of this change. So in the Southern Ocean, you have deep water that are rich in carbon and nutrients that upwell. And so if this upwelling, so if you bring deep water to the surface in a more intense way, then you can have an outgassing of carbon from the ocean into the atmosphere, basically. And we think that's what happened. So basically, there was a stronger circulation in the Southern Ocean, which drove more heat towards Antarctica, thus leading to reduction of sea ice, warmer condition, and an outgassing of CO2.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock from the University of New South Wales in Australia. We are talking with the oceanographer, Laurie Manfield. So, Laurie, let's talk about the ancient winds. What are the southern westerlies, and why do they matter to this study of climate?
Yeah, so one of the main features of the circulation in the Southern Ocean are those westerly winds, right? And they drive the circulation in the Southern Ocean, bringing what we call an upwelling, so bringing deep water to the surface. And in the ocean in general, you have more carbon stored in the deep than at the surface. And at the surface, the water equilibrates always with the atmosphere. Okay, so when you bring this deep water, which has a lot of carbon, to the surface, you expect an outgassing. So the ocean is losing carbon while the atmosphere is gaining carbon.
Several scientists on this program have presumed that as the world warms, strong westerly winds will tighten toward the South Pole, and that might change rainfall over Australia and rearrange the behavior of the Southern Ocean. Does that theory come from models, and how certain are we that that will happen?
Well, there are several aspects to it. First, this is something that has been observed over the last two decades or so. I guess you're touching one important point here, is that our instrumental record is kind of limited. It's been, I guess, 10 to 20 years that our capabilities to observe what's going on Earth has increased significantly through satellites and other means of observation, but our record is kind of short, so we need to go back in the past and try to get information to really see what's going on. But we think that over the last 20 years, the westerlies have increased in strength and have moved forward. And we can use also numerical models, so those numerical models that are developed in several countries all around the world, so in Australia, in the United States, in France, in Germany, etc., in the UK, in China as well. So those models I'll then run forward in time to try to predict, to project what is going to happen. And I think most of the models suggest that those westerlies are going to keep on strengthening and be closer to the pole. Of course, there's always some uncertainty associated to it, but this one seems to be a robust feature of the model.
You know, other scientists suggest the availability of iron for carbon-grabbing plankton may have influenced the latest warm period. Why do you emphasize the role of winds instead?
Well, I think it's not necessarily instead. I mean, we know that the iron fertilization is an important aspect. So basically, the Southern Ocean is a special region in some aspect because it's what we call a high-nutrient, low-chlorophyll region, meaning that primary production is limited not by the availability of nutrients or macronutrients, but it might be limited by a micronutrient, which is iron. So if you add iron to the ocean, you expect that the phytoplankton can grow more quickly, and this phytoplankton does photosynthesis and therefore capture carbon and bring it down to at depth. So this is important, and I don't think nobody denies it. It's just that there are also other aspects that are important, and the winds are an important part. So they are just driving also the upwelling of nutrients to the surface and changing the condition, meaning if you have, let's say, a warmer Southern Ocean, you have conditions that are maybe more favorable also for primary productivity if you have less sea ice and a warmer condition.
Laurie, are there any signals that during the relatively recent abrupt climate change that we're talking about in the last deglaciation, that the violence of storms increased? And if so, would that suggest we may experience more extreme storms if a similar shift towards those stronger westerlies and a changed ocean current happened?
Well, that's a very difficult question. So there is no record or nothing right now in our capability to see whether storms were stronger or not. Of course, that's what you would expect, I would guess. If the westerlies are stronger, you would expect more storms in the Southern Ocean. Now also the position of the westerlies is very important as to where the storms happen. So if you think about Australia, we go into an area which is maybe not my specialty, but if you think about Australia, and I think it will be more the location of the maximum of the westerlies that will impact storms more than its strength. Let's say if it's shifted to poleward, maybe storms will not reach directly Australia, etc. So that's one aspect of it. Now, for the future, of course, the strength of the westerlies will have an impact on the strength of the storm in the Southern Ocean. But again, if you go to mid-latitude countries, so Australia or other in South America, I don't necessarily know. I think the mean sea surface temperature will have a significant impact, and I think that's what we've seen in recent events, is more an increase in mean sea surface temperature that can then generate stronger storms. This is difficult because it depends a lot on which latitude you're looking into, which system you're going into. And so I'm really looking at a mean climate. And so the deviation or what you look into, extreme storm, are another area of study.
I understand. Well, look, I began by saying that the Southern Oceans are grabbing about 10% of our current emissions, and thank goodness that they are. Can you tell us how the ocean manages to capture and store so much of our greenhouse gases?
It depends a lot on the difference in atmospheric carbon dioxide composition in between the atmosphere and the ocean. So what happened is that since the Industrial Revolution, we've been adding carbon into the atmosphere at, I think, about 2 gigatons per year. So the atmospheric composition in carbon dioxide has increased from about 280 ppm to 400 ppm, which is a concentration we haven't seen in, I would say, a million years, right? So the natural viability of atmospheric CO2 over a glacial interglacial cycle is 180 ppm to 280. So here we're going way higher. So you do change as a sink and source of carbon when you do that. And as you say, thankfully, both the terrestrial biosphere and the ocean have absorbed a lot of our emissions. So about 30% has been absorbed by the terrestrial biosphere and 25% by the ocean. And a lot of this carbon has been absorbed in the Southern Ocean. The Southern Ocean is a very special place because this is where you form both the Antarctic bottom water and the Antarctic intermediate water, and in fact the subantarctic mode water. So when you form those waters, you have also the capability of absorbing carbon. Yeah, so basically we've changed, if you wish, the natural... So we are putting so much carbon into the atmosphere that the ocean now, partial pressure is lower than the atmosphere, so you're actually absorbing some of this carbon.
And a few years ago, British scientist James Lovelock warned about the ocean stagnating, breaking into layers called ocean stratification. Is that happening?
Yeah, so that's another very important point and a bit of concern, in fact, is that so what we have seen over the last 20 years and what you just said is that the southern hemispheric westerlies have strengthened and shifted poleward. Okay, so this has an impact of bringing more carbon to the surface, so you have an outgassing of carbon. But on the other side, since the circulation is fairly strong, you can also capture a lot of anthropogenic carbon. But on the other side, what we've seen, and we're still trying to understand exactly why, is that the Southern Ocean has become more stratified and maybe fresher, so indicating potentially a slowdown of this Southern Ocean circulation. So there are, in fact, almost two competing effects right now, is that one that is dynamic with the wind wanting to strengthen the Southern Ocean circulation, and one that is coming from maybe a meltwater input from Antarctica wanting to stratify the Southern Ocean and slowing down this circulation. So in the future, if we look at the coming 100 years or so, in fact, it's really unclear what is going to happen, and a lot of it will have to do into the freshwater budget close to the Antarctic coast.
Your recent article published in the journal Science on March 8th talks about a non-linear response. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean is that basically we are not really sure where we're going, right? And we've seen in the past that Earth was able to go through rapid transition. In a few hundred years, we had, you know, significant warming or significant increase in atmospheric CO2. And we're still trying to simulate that with our models and understand it. And sometimes we've highlighted some positive feedback. So if you go back to Antarctica and the Southern Ocean, we know that if you have an increase in stratification, it's possible to have a warming in the subsurface, and this subsurface warming can then melt the ice shelf, and you can have, let's say, an increase in meltwater close to the Antarctic coast, further weakening the circulation and eventually leading to a significant loss of ice mass in the Antarctic. So this is, for example, what could happen in a positive feedback case, right? So right now, I think the concern is that we don't really know where we are going. We have some ideas, and we are trying to simulate possible response, but there are still surprises coming, and I guess we hope that there are good surprises and not bad, because we're still lacking a lot of information on possible rate of change, particularly continental ice sheet.
We're going to have to leave it there. We have been speaking with award-winning young scientist Laurie Manviel from the University of New South Wales. Find links to the science we've talked about in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Laurie, thank you so much for sharing your valuable time with us.
Well, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to talk to you, and I hope it was of interest.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
On March 28th, journalist and author George Monbiot spoke at Oxford University, organized by Extinction Rebellion, he found a cause for hope. Here are a few clips from that talk, available in full on YouTube.
Thank you very much, Ben, and thank you everyone for coming. Whoa, it's fantastic. Really great to see you all. Now, Brexit does not keep me awake at night. The political meltdown taking place in Britain does not keep me awake at night. Theresa May does not keep me awake at night, though she does often feature in my nightmares. The reason these issues, huge as they are, do not keep me awake at night is that I'm already sodding awake because I'm fretting about things 1,000 times bigger. We are being faced simultaneously with a series of humongous existential crises. Climate breakdown, ecological cascading collapse, the disappearance of insects. Who knew they were important? The cascading collapse of marine ecosystems as well as terrestrial ones, driven primarily, it has to be said, by the food industry. Farming and fishing, the two most destructive industries on Earth. We give them a free pass on the basis that you can't criticize any industry that features in a children's book. We are faced with the disappearance of soil. We're faced with the contamination and disappearance in many parts of the world of fresh water. Just 2 days ago, we learned that air pollution is causing twice as much damage to our health as we previously thought. And before that point, we already knew that worldwide it was three times more deadly than AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria combined. And yet what we see from our political and economic class is a mixture of indifference and denial, occasionally grading into despair. Now, people of my generation, and I spent years grappling with this, denied and denied and denied, either that there was a problem at all or that the problem was as important as we know it is. And then suddenly, a few years ago, what they were saying changed. Suddenly, instead of saying, it's not an issue or it's not important, they said, okay, we accept, it's an issue and it's important, but sadly, it's now too late to do anything about it. Between the denial and the despair, there was not one moment at which they said, it's real, it's an issue, and therefore we must act. And faced with this indifference, this despair, this denial, I began to fall into something resembling a state of despair myself. I thought, people aren't going to see it. They refuse to see it. They don't want to know. And we tried and we tried to get mobilizations going, and we had small ones which flared up and then disappeared again like fireworks. We went up and we came down the same way. And I began to think, nothing is going to take this on. Nothing is going to tackle this. And then suddenly, two extraordinary movements emerge just where I thought, just at the moment, I thought that hope had died. Extinction Rebellion and the climate strikes. And we honour and applaud all those magnificent people who have led these two converging and essential movements. Thank you to all of them. They give me hope where hope seemed absent. They give me determination where determination was flagging. And they give me belief that for the first time in years, a belief that we really can meet these issues head on and turn around our catastrophic political and economic systems so that they serve us rather than destroy us. And on that note, I want to introduce the wonderful speakers tonight. I'll be having a bit more of a go later on. But first of all, we have two fantastic people from Extinction Rebellion. Rachel Trahan, who's an Arctic ecologist and an Extinction Rebellion activist, and Zahora Plummer, who's also a great Extinction Rebellion activist. And we'll also be hearing from Lynette, who's 16 and represents the great youth surge, which has put so many of us grey heads to shame and is showing us the way forward. So, well, thank you, everyone, for those fantastic presentations. And yeah, we need to be scared in order to see how much we have to do, and then we need to do it. Now, people often ask me, am I optimistic or am I pessimistic? And my answer is that I'm pessimistic about what people are doing to each other, doing to this wonderful planet, but I'm optimistic about what we are. Because old Thomas Hobbes was wrong. We are not engaged in a war of all against all. Broadly speaking, we're a society of altruists governed by psychopaths. I mean it. Actually, again, the science shows very clearly that those people in positions of power, many of them are radically different to the human norm. They seem to be missing those components, altruism and empathy in particular, that the rest of us possess. And in this case, selfishness and greed really are at the top of the list. This is where we're going wrong, ladies and gentlemen. Why are we letting these bastards rule us? There's a very interesting analysis by Kenneth Mackay, a Canadian professor of sociology, who's looked at the cultures that have become extinct, where they should have been to one of these talks, but because they didn't, they went over the edge and they slipped into the extinction that we're talking about as a prospect, a possibility for humanity in general now. And he was saying, well, what is the common characteristic of all these cultures? Is it that they became overcomplex? Is it that they had a particular way of engaging with the living world, which was disastrous, or with each other, were they particularly warlike? And what he found was that the common denominator was they were all governed by oligarchies, by a very small number of people who had almost absolute power over everybody else. And that the interests, the short-term interests of the oligarchs were radically different to the long-term interests of society. And so that, though everybody else might have wanted to do things differently, these people were saying, our interests are pursued by doing it this way. Now, does that seem at all familiar in the 21st century? You know, we think about the Koch brothers. We think about Donald Trump. We think about Exxon. We think about BP. We think about this tiny handful of billionaires and corporations who want to do it their way, regardless of the impacts on the rest of us. And then we think of the rest of society who are either indifferent or in denial or really want things to be different. But the great majority of people are not saying, actually, we want to be hell-bound towards extinction because that suits our short-term interests. When people are given the opportunity to act, enough people are ready to do it. And with Extinction Rebellion, with the youth climate strikes, we are seeing the rising that I have been waiting for the 33 years of my campaigning life. I honor these people. I want us all to honor them. And I want us to see that this is the beginning, not of the end, but the beginning of the beginning. The beginning of the great mass movement so many of us have been hoping to see for so long. It starts this year, ladies and gentlemen, and it starts with us. Thank you.
Find a link to the full video for George Monbiot and Friends at Oxford University, March 28th, in my show blog at ecoshock.org.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Would you like to move your city to somewhere warmer? No need. According to new science, that different climate will probably come to you. By the end of this century, some American cities will experience climates not seen before. Our tour guide is the lead author of a new paper published in Nature. Mats Fitzpatrick leads the Global Change and Biodiversity Lab at the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science. He is listed as the principal investigator, with a team of scientists, and over 50 papers published. Mat Fitzpatrick, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. Happy to be here. My actual affiliation is the full University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science, which is separate from the University of Maryland.
Well, you're talking about kids today living in a city very different when they grow up. Can you give us a quick example of what maybe New York or Washington might be like around the year 2080?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, so we're looking only at the climatic aspects, but in terms of those, you know, New York, under our current emission trajectory, by about 2080 is going to feel like northeastern Arkansas feels today. So, you know, on a summer day, that's an average of about 9 degrees Fahrenheit warmer.
When a long winter hangs on like this one, a lot of my listeners would probably love to have a climate more like San Diego or Miami. Maybe global warming will be popular. What's the problem, they think?
Well, yeah, I mean, I had other people make that similar argument that, hey, you know, I'd love for the climate in my place to be warmer. And maybe, you know, you hear a lot about the risks of climate change, and maybe that's one of the rewards. And so the question is, do those sorts of do those outweigh the significant risks? And the sorts of risks we're talking about are changes in our ability to grow food, changes in the magnitude and number of extreme weather events, sea level rise that's going to flood coastal cities, movement of people responding to climate change, right? We're talking about climate refugees, potential conflicts over water. So there's a whole host of negative consequences that come along with climate change. And so I think if people want to live in a warmer climate, they'd be better off trying to fight climate change and moving.
We know that weather is different than climate, and the weather lately is sort of all over the place. It doesn't seem normal to some people, but humans, we can't see or feel the longer trend, the real climate change. How is your work trying to help overcome that?
Well, that's right. I mean, one of the most significant barriers, I think, to doing something about this problem is that we experience, you know, daily, seasonal, annual variation in climate, and that can mask some of these trends that we've seen over time. And, you know, the way that we're trying to combat that problem is to show people, you know, climate at a place now that's going to be that best represents climate at a future time. And if, you know, someone has a general understanding about how climate changes in North America or the United States, or they've traveled to these places or they've seen them on TV, that should give them a sense of the sorts of weather they might expect, even though we're not obviously forecasting weather in year 2080.
And for the new study and the handy interactive map, which I've checked out, we can all use it. You and Robert Dunn used a tool called climate analog mapping. That word analog isn't a common word for most of us, and we certainly did not learn that kind of mapping in school. What is it?
Yeah, so this is an idea that we didn't invent. It's been around for a long time, actually. And, you know, the basic idea is we're saying what place, what climate is most analogous or most similar to the climate expected at a place at another time. And so the basic underworkings of how that goes is that we have observations of current climate, of course, and then we have forecasts of climate. These are 30-year averages forecasted from climate models. And we're just saying, you know, where is there a place that is most similar to that forecast for that location?
We do have listeners in Europe. How does your city study compare to the 2018 work, Characterization of European Cities Climate Shift, led by Guillaume Rohat?
Yeah, so that is a very similar study. You know, the ideas are basically identical. I think the only difference between the two is that we're using a slightly different statistical methodology to measure the similarities. And, of course, we're working in a different place and with different climate projections. Those are minor differences, but yeah, the idea is basically the same.
Your research covered about 75% of the population of the United States and around half of the people of Canada, but I can't find a map for climate change in Canadian cities. Is that planned?
Yeah, so actually, if you go to the map, there are, I believe the number is, there's 10 Canadian cities on the app that people can look at. Most of those are along the border with the U.S. because that's where most of the population of Canada is. But cities like Montreal, Quebec City, Ottawa, Vancouver, et cetera, are all in the map.
And do we get to go to San Diego if we're living in Vancouver?
That's a good question. Vancouver is interesting. A lot of the West Coast cities, let me just have a look while we're talking here at Vancouver. I think Vancouver actually becomes a lot like Seattle. Yeah, but the one really important caveat that I try to get across, and this is a little bit technical, so I'm gonna do this slowly. So we're trying to find the current climate that's most similar to, let's say, Vancouver's climate, 2080. So, like, where is the location that has a climate that's most similar? And we do that by looking at every single location in the map in the study region we considered. In this case, that's the Western Hemisphere north of the equator. So we look at every location, and we say, how similar is that location to 2080's climate in Vancouver? And then we find that in essence, what's the smallest distance, the closest similarity. But that doesn't mean it's actually all that similar, right? And so what we see for cities like Vancouver is that there's really not a good match, or it's a poor analog is what we would call that. And that means that the climate we expect in 2080 in Vancouver is actually unlike anything currently present in the study area that we considered. We call that climate novelty, and in more common vocabulary, we would say that, you know, the combination of precipitation or rainfall and temperature doesn't presently exist in the study area at present.
Yeah, I noticed that about the map. I mean, it seemed like various American cities in the East and the Midwest were pretty easy to understand, but the West Coast cities, in a couple of cases, you might have to go north to find an analog. And why is the West generally harder to understand?
Well, the climate patterns are more variable in the West because of the topography, because of the influence of currents along the West Coast. And elevation also plays a factor. So you mentioned some cities having an analog to the north, and that's not all that surprising. It's in essence, if you have a city that's at a high elevation, its 2080s climate might match a lower elevation, right? That's warmer and drier today, and that might happen to be north of the city. And so that's why we tend to see that in the western U.S. especially.
Right, that makes total sense. So, previously, one of the challenges of science was interpreting global data into a local projection. How did you drill down to the city level when previous studies and reports have had difficulty doing that?
That's right. So, you know, the data that come out of these global climate models are what we would call relatively coarse spatial resolution. And you might think of this as, like, you know, take a map and chop it into squares of equal size. And those squares are pretty big in terms of how the data comes out of the climate model. To get to the level of cities, we used data that had been what's known as statistically downscaled. So there's these techniques where they take the information from climate models and they reduce the spatial resolution down. The equivalent process, one way to think about this is older digital cameras, right? The older digital cameras might have, you know, they might be like 1 or 2 megapixels, right? That's like the number of pixels in the image that you take, and whereas today's cameras might be 12 megapixels, let's say. So in essence, that's what's happening is that we didn't do this work. This was done by an outside group, but they're taking these coarser resolution outputs from climate models, and they're statistically downscaling them to a more fine resolution, and that's the data that we used.
I did some digging around in the charts, and I was looking at Washington, D.C., and it appears to me from your paper, if we start from the period 1960 to 1990 as our baseline, the worst-case emissions scenario means that around March 2080 or so, Washington would be about 10 degrees Fahrenheit warmer both days and nights, and would experience an extra day of rain. Now, Matt, aren't we currently on the IPCC worst-case emissions pathway right now?
Yeah, we are. I believe we're either on that pathway or we've exceeded it or are exceeding it. And so we're on track, given current emission rates and the speed of global action, to be in the worst-case scenario.
Matt, how did you account for the other side of climate change, the new hydrology, the new patterns of humidity and storms and extreme precipitation events which are hitting the U.S. right now?
Right, so all of those factors we basically had to ignore. So what we're talking about are 30-year averages of climate. So we use the term 2080, right, as the time frame we're talking about in the future. But what that actually refers to is the average of the period 2070 to 2099. So it's a 30-year average of climate. You know, we're not considering changes in the frequency of extreme events or any of those sorts of things that come along with these changes. We're also not considering sea level rise. That's going to probably be potentially the larger impact for low-lying coastal cities. And we're not considering things that are going to make the problem worse, like heat island effects, right? So the interior of cities are often several degrees warmer than the surrounding suburbs or countryside, given the large amount of buildings and that sort of thing that hold heat. So in a lot of ways, what we're showing here is conservative, potentially.
We know warming's going to continue for centuries after 2080, and I'm wondering, should we consider the same study for the year 2180 if we're trying to weigh up the risks of what we're doing now, or is that just too far out for us to even guess what might happen by then?
Yeah, I mean, I they can certainly simulate climate out that far, and potentially people have. I'm not 100% sure. But, you know, this is one of the challenges of climate change, is that not only are the effects gradual, but they accumulate over time, and the severity of them becomes worse. But thinking even to 2080 is more than I think we as humans are readily able to conceptualize. Even though it is the lifetime of our children, you know, we're more worried about what's going to happen tomorrow or next week than we are about things that are several decades away. And so, you know, to me, this is the sort of problem that really requires a policy solution, because it has to change behavior now to have a benefit multiple decades in the future.
And according to your recent work, most northern cities will have climate more like what is seen in the south, more or less, today. So what happens to cities that are in the tropics now?
Yeah, that's a great question. The closest we get to the tropics in our analyses are like southern Florida, southern Texas, that sort of thing. Yeah, I mean, there's a study that looked at a global perspective. It wasn't looking at cities, but it was looking at the idea of what I spoke about earlier about climate novelty. And it asked, you know, where do novel climates arise in the future, given climate change? And oftentimes, these novel climates are in the tropics, because the tropics are becoming warmer and that sort of thing. And so what I would say about, you know, cities in the tropics, there's probably not a good current analog for what those places will be like in the future, and that their climates will be unlike anything that we see potentially anywhere on Earth today.
Well, it's possible in some places where the humidity is high enough that those cities may be empty and those people may move north or south just to find a more habitable climate.
Yeah, that's possible. I mean, humans have a way of figuring out how to inhabit some pretty extreme places.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Matt Fitzpatrick, and he's with the Fitzpatrick Lab at the University of Maryland. His latest work lets you see the coming climate in 540 American cities. Matt, the majority of the world's population now live in cities, and megacities are still expanding. How vulnerable are big cities to a shift in climate within one generation?
That's a good question. I mean, it's a bit outside of my expertise to think about it that way. The way that I think about cities and their vulnerability is that they're not natural environments, right? By their definition, they're heavily built environments. There's lots and lots of infrastructure in place to support population densities, transportation, et cetera. And so the extent to which those systems are or are not buffered from climate events could make those sorts of places very vulnerable to climate change.
Thinking about city planning, even with your new map, you say cities can't just click on a future and plan for that, because with climate disruption, well, how can city planners prepare for a variable future?
That's a good question. I mean, part of our initial goal with this was to potentially provide some forward-looking information to people making planning decisions, like, you know, looking at if my city is going to become like this location, you know, what are their cooling needs and buildings and that sort of thing. Reviewers actually pushed back on us on that and said, well, you know, this method hasn't been demonstrated to be useful for that, and you're speculating. So we removed a lot of that. So, you know, I think it's an open question, the extent to which climate analog mapping can be used for that purpose. But it should at least provide a sense of, you know, the sort of climate that these cities may experience, and that could translate into building codes and infrastructure development and engineering and that sort of thing. But again, I think it's a bit of an open question.
So people click on the map at tinyurl.com/urbanclimate. Perhaps they see what the future might look like for where they live, for their kids at least. Then we have to drive to work. Do we know if awareness really leads to action that will prevent a bad outcome with our climate?
That, too, is an open question. That's one that we're very interested in pursuing here at the Appalachian Lab. We're curious about the use of a tool like this in terms of not just informing the public, but does it change people's engagement or awareness and that sort of thing? Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure. I'd like to think it does, but the reality is we all have a lot of other things to think about. And again, that's where I think a policy solution is probably the best way to address this problem.
Before we wrap up, Matt, I'd like to just take a peek at some of your other research. You are an expert in phenology. What is that, please?
A lot of the work I do is related to the response of natural systems to climate variability, and what that tells us about how they might respond to future climate change. Some of my work works on phenology, which is basically the timing of events in the natural world. That means typically, you know, phenology events are very prominent in the spring and the fall, right? So flowers are blooming, leaves are coming out, birds are arriving in the north. So these are all phenological events. And climate is a big driver of when those events happen. And when the timing of those events change, they often have ripple effects through ecosystems. So there's lots of examples of changes in phenology events impacting other aspects of ecological systems.
We have been talking with Matt Fitzpatrick, head of the Global Change and Biodiversity Lab at the University of Maryland. On February 12, 2019, Matt and Robert Dunn published the paper Contemporary Climate Analogs for 540 North American Urban Areas in the Late 21st Century. Find that interactive map at tinyurl.com/urbanclimate. I'll put links in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Matt, thank you for giving us a good look at what could be a bad situation.
You bet, Alex. My pleasure.
At the end of last week, major cities in North Korea were threatened by wildfires. Early fires have already appeared in Western North America. Songwriter David Rovics realized he is an early climate change refugee, avoiding the summer smoke in Portland, Oregon, for a coffeehouse in Denmark. But then, projections for rising seas show Denmark could disappear as a country as surely as low-lying Pacific islands. Nobody escapes global climate change disruption. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned to your future with Radio EcoShock.